to the second case of the day, Chuvari Capital v. Simpkins. Mr. Stierney?
Morning, Your Honors. My name is Ron Stierney. I represent the plaintiff. I know this probably isn't exciting, judging by how we cleared out the gallery as EPA standards, but this is a very important case to my client, as evidenced by the fact that we're coming back a second time on this case. Would the court care for an overview of the facts?
Well, we're familiar with the brief,
right.
So...
Then I'll get right into it. Given that this was a bench trial, and the deference that's normally accorded to a bench trial, I still think that there is a basis for reversal, and the reasoning is quite simple, that the majority of the facts in the case are uncontested, but also the district court's ruling and the facts he cited were either improperly applied or just plain wrong based on the record. And the standard of review, which we cite in our brief, is... doesn't require me to show that necessarily that there were no facts, that the court had no facts to support it. There could be facts, but whether or not it was fair to apply those facts in that manner. So in this case, I believe we're in stronger ground because of the fact that, for example, the district court's view of the issue of the phase two was just plain wrong based on the testimony.
But again, what you're faced with is what we... sitting as a court of appeals is essentially second-guessing the trial court, right?
But not in this case, because it would be different if we were talking, for example, a police brutality case where the plaintiff says the officer beat me and the officer says, no, I didn't, and then it's shades of gray. Here, the district court took a view of the facts that simply wasn't there, and it's not a question of credibility, as the court said. The court sprinkled the magic credibility sauce onto his three defendants, all right? But what I'm doing is I'm grabbing the bull by the horn, so to speak, and I'm saying, looking at their testimony, the credible so-called credible witnesses' testimony, and what they said contradicts the view that the district court took of the facts. The other part of this equation is the fact that the district court didn't even look outside of his view of what he should be doing. The district court went into this trial with the view that all he had to find out was whether negotiations continued past the point of Mr. Simpkins' letter. The district court felt that the opinion that was handed down in reversing the summary judgment grant mandated that all he had to do was make that determination. And as I pointed out in my brief, I think I was entitled to more. I think I was entitled to put on my whole case in chief, and I attempted to do that in the confines of the time that the district court allowed. The district court made really 4 points as to the basis for his decision. His view was exemplified in the beginning of the trial when, at the conclusion of the witness's testimony, he asked them, when did negotiations end? When did negotiations end? But this being a diversity case and the designation of the controlling law being Illinois, we look at Illinois' law on bad faith. And Illinois says that good faith is decency, fairness, and reasonableness in negotiations. And what happened here was not just that there was a lack of decency, but an outright statement of misrepresentations of fact that the plaintiff relied on. So to just look at the facts and say, well, negotiations, people were talking about something, someone showed up, that wasn't the test. The district court needed to look at all of the things that had happened leading up to the end of this transaction, not just to say that people were talking to each other. But that's the view that the district court had. And he asked these questions to these witnesses, and at the conclusion of the first day of testimony, admonished counsel and said, look, these are the only questions that matter to him. And notwithstanding, I put on the case that I was entitled to put on, and that was my case in chief as in that time period. And as the case went on, and even in, for example, Mr. Gaddin, one of the credible witnesses that the district court found credible, when he was asked the magic question, he says the negotiations were over when I left in September. Now remember, the LOI had that cutoff of September 30th, which the defendants refused to yield on. So when he said that he was out of it in September, that contradicts the district court's position.
Well, he was replaced by somebody else, right?
Pardon me?
He was replaced by somebody else.
Mr. Brandt.
Right.
Mr. Brandt.
So that his testimony doesn't establish that negotiations ended. His part ended.
That's how the case sort of evolved, because at the beginning the district judge was viewing it as, well, where negotiations going? But Mr. Brandt testified that he was negotiating a new deal. He said, we stopped on this deal for this finance transaction because that wasn't going to happen, and he ticked off of several reasons for that. He said Mr. Simpkins would never be comfortable with a finance transaction. It was just not doable with the
letter of intent didn't specify that this deal could only be a finance transaction.
That is
correct. There's some evidence that that was an option, but it wasn't required, so that issue doesn't cut necessarily the way you want it to cut.
No, that's true, Judge.
That's why we defer to the trial judge to interpret.
Well, the district judge's statement was that the LOI, because the LOI didn't mandate a finance transaction, that it could be any sort of an asset purchase agreement. But the LOI said, negotiations toward a definitive asset purchase agreement, and as I cited the law in Illinois, when you give intent to a contract, you have to, if it's plain on its face, that's the intent. And in the contract itself, section 9E on the LOI, it says that that it's necessary that the plaintiff obtain financing and get due diligence satisfactory to obtain that financing. And in addition to that, because parts of this LOI were binding and other parts were not, so it was just basically any letter, you look at the broader discussions between the parties, and from the get-go, everyone said this was a finance transaction. Mr. Gaddin called our client a bottom feeder, highly leveraged, and when he was asked on the stand what highly leveraged means, he said it means they don't have any money. And that was in March.
Well, right, but there were lots of discussions also that that investors might be attracted, sufficient to consummate the deal, and that therefore financing wasn't necessary.
Well,
I mean, it was
there
all
was,
open.
There was a mention in the stipulation about Mr. Sekola's reference to having individuals who could invest in the deal, but any investment, regardless of the source, requires adequate due diligence, which is another aspect of this case that the district judge didn't address, which is getting the due diligence items that the buyer requested. So, for example, the buyer sent over the list of due diligence items that they needed to complete their investigation prior to the sale of property. So whether the money comes from a bank, which says, this is what we need, here's the list, get it, or whether it comes from private investors, if the plaintiff, the negotiator, said, this is what I need to do this transaction, it doesn't matter where the money is coming from per se. Similarly, on the issue of the phase two, the district judge sidestepped that based on Mr. Harlan's testimony, which was a defense witness. Now, Mr. Harlan was brought in by the defendants to testify to the fact that they didn't need the phase two. But that's like asking Mr. Harlan, was there any DNA evidence in this case? Mr. Harlan had the portion of the transaction that dealt with the receivables. He was loaning on receivables. He had no need for the phase two. But Mr. Harlan did confirm that whoever was giving money on the real estate, and there was testimony that there was going to be a sale leaseback, that we had hired Staubach Realty to assist with that, they all said, you're going to need the phase two. That's because the phase one said it. And so at the beginning of this transaction in June, in early June, the first thing that happened, the phase ones occurred, and we right away said, we need the phase twos. If you're not going to do the phase twos, we're not going forward with this transaction. And the people at Mesiro confirmed that. And in fact, Bill Hornell, who was the head of that team at Mesiro, at one point in an email said, I don't mean to be an advocate for Randy, but how are you ever going to get a lender to loan on real estate without the phase two? So throughout, at no point throughout these negotiations, did anyone ever reference these outside lenders and say, look, we'll just skip the financing. The whole basis of this transaction, the one we're talking about, is a finance transaction. So the district court's sidestep to say, well, the APA didn't have to be for a finance transaction. Nobody was talking about anything else. So if we determine this case in the context of the negotiations of the parties, which is what should happen, without the phase two, without the due diligence items and everything else, there was never going to be a finance transaction.
Well, the seller never committed to provide the phase two studies.
They did, Judge. They did. They repeatedly did. At the beginning, when we said we want the phase twos done,
The letter of intent?
It's not in the letter of intent, but it was in the negotiations between the parties back and forth. I think there's two, it's sort of a hybrid situation, because you have a letter of intent, and typically those aren't contracts themselves. We do have one section of the letter of intent, which is a contract, and that is, if the seller terminates the agreement, they're going to pay the breakup fee. That's binding. But in the rest of the whole part of this case, it's a straight-up negotiation, and that's where good faith comes in, whether they were exhibiting good faith in their negotiations. And in the beginning part of the negotiations, we said, as a precondition for us to go further in this case, you need to do the phase twos. And they said yes, and they would do the phase twos. Mr. Battaglia said in an email after that came out and said, we will be selecting our vendor within a week or two. And it's over and over, Mr. Gallo, who was the consultant, also was harping on them about these phase twos. When are you going to get this done? When are you going to get this done? But the fact of the matter is they sat across from us at the negotiation table, and they lied to us. They said, we're going to do it. And then subsequently in this case, we find out that behind the scenes, they said, we told them we're going to do it, but here's what we're going to do really. We're going to get through this, all this financing and the due diligence, find out where we stand, and then we'll try and convince them to do the phase two afterwards. And the reasoning was clearly laid out. If they do a phase two investigation and they find environmental contamination, they've got to clean it up. And they didn't want to do that. So that's why they shifted it off and hid that. And on that point, I reference the cases from this court regarding letters of intent. And in one of them, and I believe it's Feldman, the issue is a party can bargain hard, and indeed the defendants have taken that as their mantra in this case. Hard bargaining is okay, but that's only with demands. You can make any demand you want, and that's fair game. The difference is here is that there was a representation that was false, and that representation was that we're going to do the phase two, and that's not a demand. And that continued all the way through, up until the point that Mr. Gadden issued his 6 points memorandum with requirements, 5 points, and I think the pinnacle of it was saying, I'm not going to proceed unless you give us a release, a full, unbridled release. And one of the components of bad faith or the test of bad faith is if you issue demands that are inconsistent with the not bargaining of the parties. I believe my time is almost up, Your Honor. I think that, you know, if the court looks at all of the elements that I outlined in my brief about what happened in terms of the negotiations, this is not just a situation of hard bargaining, but what is fair and what is decent in terms of good faith as you sit across from a contract negotiating table.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Stearns. Mr. McKay?
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Tom McKay, and I represent the appellees. Your Honor, when we talk about the negotiations in this case and the letter of intent, what we had, in fact, was an agreement among two parties to simply do that, negotiate towards an asset purchase agreement. The negotiations were contentious. They were long. They dealt with a lot of issues, not just phase twos. They dealt with financing. Mr. Cerny said that we lied about going forward with the phase twos. Well, you know, there's different ways of looking at that. The bank that Trivari had itself said that it would not even get into loaning on the real estate. So the phase twos was not even an issue. In fact, what we found out is that the plaintiff never had any sort of commitment whatsoever for anyone to finance the real estate. That was discovered sometime in late July, early August. That's when Mr. Gadden, the attorney for Simpkins, started pressing the plaintiff, "Where's the money? Show me the money." The plaintiff returned by saying, "We need the phase twos. Show me the money. We need the phase twos. My bank cannot do the due diligence." It was banter back and forth. But if we look at the record and what the court had before Judge Gettleman, we discover that the plaintiff did not have any sort of financing whatsoever on the real estate. And that was a significant portion of the transaction that was to be negotiated.
How did the remediation of the land play into this?
Remediation of the land did not play into the letter of intent at all. It was a term that the plaintiff raised to be negotiated in the asset purchase agreement. But remediation is something that you would have to do a phase two. You would have to find out, are there any environmental issues that need to be cleaned up? And if so, what's the purpose or what's the use of the property? And depending on that use, you would have to have different standards you'd have to comply with, you know, under the federal EPA as well as the state EPAs.
There had been no determination of even estimated cost?
No, there had been no determinations with respect to the phase twos. There were proposals that were received from phase two environmental consultants. One proposal was received in late June, and it was $120,000 to perform the soil borings and subsurface exploration for the various properties, which is a significant expense that was not anticipated when the parties entered into the letter of intent. As the court properly noted, as did Judge Gettleman, there is no mention of the obligation of a phase two to be borne by either party. That was simply one of the requests that the plaintiff had during the terms of the negotiations. It was not a deal breaker. It did not kill the deal. In fact, you know, this is the second time it's up on appeal, so I don't want to belabor the record, but this court, the first time around, was presented with a paper record. And this court found that there may be questions of fact regarding the negotiations, whether they're proper negotiations, whether the defendant was stringing along the defendant simply not to pay the breakup fee. I would tell this court that the amount of attorney's fees, the cost for consultants, soliciting bids, having Mesro as the broker, those costs far exceeded any breakup fee. This was a deal that the Simpkins family wanted to do, and they continue to want to do it well into November. And there's every single witness that was that gave testimony at the bench trial testified consistently that, yes, negotiations were ongoing. Mr. Sokola claims that, no, it was a deal breaker. We weren't allowed to do our due diligence, and therefore the deal was over. However, there is a September 6, 2007 correspondence, which is Plaintiff's Exhibit 59, in which Mr. Sokola addresses Mr. Leon Simpkins and states in pertinent part, you know, quote, "I remain interested in consummating the deal to acquire the assets of Simpkins as contemplated in the LOI and remain confident that we can close," period, end quote. That's September 6, 2007. That's 2 weeks after the plaintiff itself had terminated the LOI by sending a demand for the breakup fee. Despite the fact that the plaintiff did that in August 21st, Mr. Gadden, the attorney for the defendants, still tried to get a deal done, agreed to do the phase twos. Let me revise that. Not just agreed to do the phase twos, but went further with the proposals on the phase twos so they could explore what, in fact, would be the cost to, if they had to, remediate the properties prior to the closing. So, Your Honors, I don't believe that there's anything in the record. There's no clear error that Judge Gettleman committed. He simply weighed all the evidence. And he took into consideration inconsistent testimony between Mr. Sokola and TCF Bank, who was doing the financing for the working capital portion of the deal. And Mr. Harland of TCF said, we are only doing one aspect. The other aspect with respect to the real estate, which implicates all the phase twos, that's somebody else. Mr. Sokola would have this court believe that he had financing in place or that due diligence was preventing him from getting that financing. But in fact, the only thing that he had was an initial proposal from Chase Bank saying that they may be interested in financing the real estate portion of the deal. That never materialized. Nothing ever came of that. So we're sitting here even September 6, 2007, Mr. Sokola saying, I want to do a deal. He doesn't have any financing for the real estate portion of the deal. And he, in fact, did not have final bank commitment from TCF Bank regarding the working capital.
Well, to get back, your opponent's primary argument was there was unimpeached testimony, and therefore the court was required to take it as proffered.
I disagree with that, Your Honor. Mr. Sokola's testimony was contradicted, not necessarily impeached. It was contradicted by other witnesses, including Mr. Sokola's own banker, Mr. Harlan. And the fact that, Your Honor, Mr. Sokola never presented any evidence at trial that he did, in fact, have financing for the real estate portion of the deal. In terms of the due diligence, Mr. Battaglia, the CFO for the defendant, provided the plaintiff with all the financials, profit and loss statements, an audited financial statement from an outside CPA, an unaudited financial statement. Mr. Sokola had all the numbers that he needed to get financing for the working capital portion, as well as he had appraisals, you know, valuations for the real estate that he could have at least got a bank interested to fund that portion of the deal. So, Your Honor, we would ask that this court affirm the judgment of Judge Gettleman. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. McCready. Mr. Cerny?
You know, there was again this reference to Mr. Harlan, but as Mr. Sokola testified and as Mr. Gallo testified, there was multi-sources of investments to do with this, to finance this deal. Mr. Harlan was only one person who was financing on the receivables or one asset of this purchase. So to say, hey, he didn't show us any evidence, that's specious because Mr. Harlan was their witness who they cherry-picked and said, whoa, now there's no financing for the real estate. But that's because that was their witnesses. That's who they called. And then they said he didn't finance the real estate. And the respondent argued, well, he didn't have a commitment. Well, that's the whole point. We were trying to get a commitment. We needed this done so that we could get a commitment. It was laid out over and over and over again. A commitment letter is just that. The bank says, we commit to giving you this money. The bank or anyone else is not going to commit until they get information to secure themselves that this is a good deal. Respondent's counsel referred to Mr. Gaddin's email where he said we're going to do the phase twos. Well, that's what they told us repeatedly. And as a matter of fact, Mr. Gaddin in his testimony at trial admitted he had no authority. He had no authority to bind Mr. Simpkins. Mr. Brand had no authority. And I asked Mr. Gaddin what was his basis for making these negotiating points. He said silence gives consent. Silence from his client, who was getting copied allegedly on all these emails, but Mr. Simpkins, who testified, he didn't have a computer. Didn't have a computer, never opened an email. I would ask that Your Honors reverse based on the fact that there was bad faith in this transaction. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Attorney. Mr. Mulcahy, thank you. Case is taken under